job down at the local mill. Worked right up, not a minute till I can pay my bills. The repo man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, kids, a car, and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by our listener-supported community radio station, WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and live webcast live worldwide at WFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners to WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners to WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives not only to democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. And we, in addition to our regular news stories and stuff today, we're expecting a couple guests to come in today. So hopefully they'll show up here pretty soon. But in the meantime, I guess there's been a lot happening, hasn't there, Gus?
Oh,
both locally and nationally.
Yeah, we'll save the local for later because that's going to be a very that's going to be a very powerful conversation in the sense of what's going on here in Champaign. But nationally, everybody's gearing up for Tuesday. Tuesday is Super Tuesday, where multiple states will have their primaries for both the Republican and Democratic parties. And so far, they've had the final debates gearing up for this Tuesday. But one of the things that you haven't heard much about are the working class people. You hear the term middle class, et cetera, but you don't hear the realities of the working class. But surprisingly, some of the biggest news periodicals put out some amazing studies this past week that the politicians themselves are not acknowledging. Because what's going on is the reality of life in America for working people is drastically at odds with the official picture of a society in the seventh year of a slow economic recovery in which the population is generally prosperous and certainly not in desperate straits. But the seething anger amongst working people, expressed in only a very limited and distorted way in the presidential campaign, is the product of deepening economic and social tensions. Numerous reports released during the first 2 months of 2016, and this is from one of the reports that came out, of the staggering dimensions of the social crisis facing working people in the United States. A majority of Americans have too little savings to pay for an emergency expense of $1,000. One in four U.S. adults is burdened by debt caused by medical expenses, and more than 1 million working people are being cut off food stamps. 1 million retirees face pension cuts dictated by the Obama administration. And the only instance of actual care that has been given to working people, and it's only because of political posturing, has been the Flint, Michigan human rights crisis of water. But again, that itself has been not only depoliticized, but also used as some type of a electoral politics strategy for the people. The people are not being considered. But here's the big story that came out on the front page of the New York Times on Thursday. A study by a think tank group called the Economic Innovation Group found that more than 50 million Americans are living in communities defined by postal zip codes that are severely distressed economically. And what the study did was the study used measures of education, poverty rate, unemployment, housing, vacancy rate, median income, and trends in employment and business formation to calculate figures for economic distress. It identified the 10 worst urban areas in terms of economic distress in order: Cleveland, Detroit, Newark, Toledo, San Bernardino, Stockton, Milwaukee, Buffalo, Memphis, and Cincinnati. The state of Texas had the largest number of people living in distressed zip codes, 5.2 million, while the state of Mississippi had the highest proportion of its population living in distress. 40% of people living in Mississippi fall into that category of distressed economic conditions. In the most distressed 20% of zip codes, the study found that nearly a quarter of adults have no high school degree, over half of the adults are not working, and the median income is only two-thirds of the state level. Since the 2008 Wall Street crash, these zip codes lost on average 6.7% of their jobs and haven't come back, and 8.3% of their businesses that never came back. Their housing stock was on average more than 50 years old.
Wow.
And finally, contrasting the economic conditions in the distressed areas with those in high income, high growth areas, and these are zip codes located mainly in the centers of finance and high technology thanks to neoliberalization, including New York City, Boston, Dallas, and San Francisco. The EIG, which was that think tank, they observed that it's almost like you are looking at two separate countries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, and so what this, what these reports are starting to show, and there's more data if you want to have a chance to look at the New York Times, is on the front page of Thursday and on the website as well. But what you see happening here is that, you know, people have been talking about for a few years now that there's been a divide amongst the rich and the poor, but they're not being critical enough. It's not getting deep enough at the heart of, we're talking about a class struggle, a warfare between the classes at this point. I mean, so it's not the same as that they're just separate now, but they are in antagonism against one another, with the masses are the ones that are suffering the most and trying to resist. So that's the point. We need to really start thinking more deeply about this. And this should be the new, after these Super Tuesday garbage is over, this needs to be the number one thing that I'm not hearing these so-called activists and these so-called union leaders talking about. Are these types of statistics when you approach Hillary Clinton or you approach a some type of politician, you know, you should be giving them this data and making them say something about it instead of giving them some generalized statement about some type of identity politics. We need to understand that we are an oppressed group and that these statistics show that we are headed into a very bad situation economically in this country.
Yeah, and what really surprised me there, Gus, was Cleveland's worse off than Detroit.
Yeah, Cleveland is number one in economic distress, and we're talking about poverty rate, unemployment, and these are all the things calculated together: poverty rate, unemployment, education opportunities, median household income. So it's about six different things that they put together in the report.
Yeah.
So Cleveland's number one.
And, you know, also these places that you mentioned, New York, Boston, San Francisco, I mean, those places have been, I mean, this is a trend that's been happening for several years now, if not even a decade or two, is that, those cities are, live in the city center. I mean, it's so expensive to live that only, the very well off can live there.
Yeah.
And that the poor and working class, I mean, I know in the case of San Francisco, if you didn't buy a home, like say back in the, sometime before the, early mid 1980s, I mean, you're gonna have to live like anywhere from an hour and a half to 2 hours away from those city centers to be able to afford a place to live.
Yeah.
You know, so it's almost becoming like these cities are becoming almost like Disneyland's amusement parks, if you will, for the the wealthy to one degree or another. You know, the somewhat wealthy to the ultimate 1% rich. You know,
right? Yeah. But look how big it is. Also, you know, it's so big, and so the bigger, the more people. And
but just. Yeah, I was just going to say, but you know, what happened was, you know, back in the 70s, I think this started probably really back in the late 60s, was you had all people with money started moving out of the city. And even people that were just like sort of fairly well-off working class started moving out of the city. Yeah. They started moving out in the suburbs. And then starting in, I don't know, sometime in the late 80s, all of a sudden people with money wanted to move back into the city. You know, they wanted to be close to, you know, entertainment and, you know, right. that kind of thing, restaurants and everything. And so they started pushing the poor out. You know, basically emptying out housing projects. You know, instead of renovating these public housing, they basically just let them go to heck and then tore them down, moved the poor out to where a lot of these cities, I know Chicago has what's called the donut effect now, to where you got the really well-off living in the city center, you got some very well-off living way out in the suburbs, and then in the middle there, kind of like, it looks like, a donut if you draw it on a map, where you got the poor, which are in the older suburbs, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you think about it historically, really the invention of the internet was one of the biggest accomplishments for neoliberalization to occur, because what happened in those cities and those urban areas is that they became financial networks to basically be the hub for global capitalism, mm-hmm. to connect to different parts of the world at that point. So that at that point, you know, these centers become these financial areas, then there's no need to, you know, like I said, there's a big thing here about deindustrialization and suburbanization. The main reason why the middle class moved out of the cities is because not only the land got cheaper out there, but also they wanted to disconnect from the masses because they saw the suburban areas as being more, you know, more culturally, what's the word? You know, that they felt like it was a better place for their class.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so that, you know, all that brought in. So when these urban areas become the financial centers and the deindustrialization kills these cities, all of the jobs move out. So they're building up all this new infrastructure. So it becomes an attractive place for the petty bourgeoisie to come back to the cities, mm-hmm. and also work in finance in those network hubs. And again, we use the internet a lot and we talk about how great it is to have this technology, but the internet is the number one critical asset that capitalists have used to create imperialism and to continue global capitalist hegemony. And so we have to really scrutinize what the internet is really created for. It was created for the everyday people to use. And that's why you see these different government structures trying to take away freedom of the internet.
Yeah.
Because let's be honest, it's not for us.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's a powerful medium though. I mean, it could be used, but I mean, it's been used, well for organizing activities. However, it definitely has its limitations though, you know. Yeah. There's nothing that beats face-to-face organizing, one-on-one, person-to-person, you know. The internet puts this is a good point you make, Gus. I mean, you know, really, you think about, it seems like with every, you know, like, if you want to call it an advance in tech, well, it's definitely an advance in technology, but you know, you look at how its impact on society, it's definitely a mixed bag and probably for working people, probably worse off. Mm-hmm. I mean, people, you know, I guess you have the potential to access information. Well, of course you do. You have the potential to access information worldwide and actually see what's going on somewhere in real time worldwide. But the problem is there's so much information thrown out. There's so many distractions, mm-hmm. that basically the average person out there, it's like they're just overwhelmed with it. And it's like, you know, it's difficult unless you know where, what you're looking for and where you're going. You can't really find it. It's not available, you know.
Exactly.
So, but that's an interesting point. I never considered that aspect of it as far as the centralization of the financial sectors, you know.
I mean, that's what David Harvey talks about in A Brief History of Neoliberalization, or mm-hmm. neoliberalism.
Okay.
Is that one of the goals or the accomplishments of the neoliberalization project is financial capital. Financial mm-hmm. centers are built mm-hmm. in urban sectors because you have to be able to maintain. There's so much capital globally at this point because it's not in one space. Mm-hmm. So it's harder to maintain without that internet because that links everything together. And like you say, at the drop of a dime, you know, even going past dial-up now, to the plug-in in the wall to now wireless.
Yeah.
It's so much quicker and faster now to connect those things for these corporations to do what they do and also for the military to do what they do. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's really one of the most critical aspects. And you're right. The internet is a very important, mobilizing tool, but we have to be very critical of the internet and what it really is used for and understand that, because that's something that they never teach, because you realize that once the internet first came, the American Online and all the other stuff came, that's when cities really started emptying out, because those banks and those financial centers really started taking off in San Francisco and Dallas and all these other major cities.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you know, that rent goes up, The poor people are pushed out. And like you say, some of the upper working class, the petty bourgeoisie, they assist in the pushing out as the indirect rulers. So, you know, a sort of internal neocolonialism. Mm-hmm. The different people talk about, like Herbert Bloner, Martin Oppenheimer, and a few others. I mean, this is something that we really need to consider, is this idea of the internal colonial theory, neocolonialism in America.
Yeah, not to mention that, you know, after the upheavals of the, labor strife in the 1930s, that a lot of cities implemented what was called rent control.
Oh, yeah.
To where, you know, and that's almost, I don't think exist anymore unless somebody's fairly elderly. I mean, that's kind of grandfathered or grandmothered into it, mm-hmm. you know. But, yeah, that's another thing. I mean, that's, you know, it's, when you talk to younger people, when you tell them about some things that used to be, I mean, it's almost like you're talking about a science fiction novel or something, because it's just hard to comprehend.
I mean, really what we have to really look at as well, and this is something I forgot to mention earlier, is where do the working people fit into this structure?
Mm-hmm.
Wages.
Mm-hmm.
The wages are the one thing that you have not heard a single thing about. Even Bernie Sanders mm-hmm. has not talked about wage stagnation, because even though you have a so-called quote unquote recovery happening, wages are stagnating since the 2008 recession. The numbers are still at this point for the last quarter of 2015, total employment cost broadening measure wages and benefits. You only had a total increase of 0.6%, and those were for mostly white collar jobs. When you look at all the other ones, when you look at blue collar work, you look at industrial work, the few jobs that are left, and also the service sector work.
Mm-hmm.
All those are down almost 1% across the board, and they're going down steadily over the next few years.
Because it doesn't really seem like none of this has to do with the people, the working people. It seems like that everybody is, that the rich is getting richer and the poor is getting poorer. It's about the 1% of the people that have the power. And you know what? It's not about us.
Yeah.
The people, I mean, no matter what you do, what we say, how many riots or how many, none of that matters, because we're still not getting anywhere. I mean, we can still, you know, do our thing, but it's not about the people. And that's what people not understanding.
Yeah, but I would push it to say that there's something happening in the world, in the U.S., in terms of collective consciousness about oppression. So I wouldn't say that there's nothing that can be done, because what happened in Greece last year, what happened in all these other countries, what's happening in the U.S. in relation to social crises, you know, Flint, Michigan, also race relations, police brutality, and across the globe, something is happening. It's happening very slowly. Let's not forget, the Russian Revolution took, 12, 13 years to really catch on until the actual February, October revolutions. So, you know, it's a process that something is bubbling here. And the fact that, and again, I'm softening on Bernie Sanders, but the fact that he has the ability to talk about that class structure and the problems of class that has never really been addressed before he became a candidate, that lets you know that there is something. Because most people, he would be at the point where he would be washed off of the ticket. Nobody would listen to him 10 years ago. So the fact that he's able to do that now shows that something is happening amongst the masses. Because we're the ones that determine if he gets any airplay or any time, because we keep tuning in. And now he's become a popular opponent against Hillary.
Yeah, despite the efforts of the corporate media to ignore him.
Exactly.
You know, this is what's intriguing about that. But yeah, you look at any point in history. I mean, the United States, for instance, you know, you had the stock market crash that happened in October 29. I mean, things didn't really, explode until 5 years later in 1934, when you had three general strikes happening in three major cities in this country, not to mention all the other stuff going on. Textile strikes in the South, tenant farmers in the South striking, all these little places all over the country, not to mention the epidemic of rural bank robberies that was going on, in which the bank robbers were considered folk heroes to most of the people.
Yep.
You know, that all exploded. All that really came on, I mean, all at one time in 1934.
Yeah.
You know, and so it took 5 years to percolate, if you will. And this is just how I guess it is with human nature. People, you know, they have problems and troubles, and they're going to do whatever they can to try to get by. They're going to try to finagle or, cut back or, you know, just grin and bear it. But after a certain point, you know, it's just enough's enough.
And that's why things like, you know, we just did this lecture, Lou Turner, I think you've had him on the show before, but he's like the big, you know, the
major. I've met Lou Turner. Yeah. I've never had him on the show. I'd like to get him on sometime.
Major Fanon scholar. He just did a lecture last night on Frantz Fanon.
You know, oh, yes.
You know, mm-hmm. For those that aren't listening.
Wretched of the Earth.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Wretched of the Earth. Yeah, Frantz Fanon was a scholar activist, a psychiatrist, sociologist who actually engaged in the Algerian Revolution, actually participated in it. And one of the things that he argues is exactly what you say, is that there's a point to where there are stages that happen that lead to revolution. And one of the stages that you can't skip is what you said. You try to figure out some way to deal with the pressure, the problems. It has a strain on your body. It has a strain on your mind. You know, you develop diseases and things. You have to go through that to get to the point to where you shed that and you basically awaken to the possibility of revolution. That it's something you have to go through, and you're basically reborn in the struggle to fight against oppression.
Yeah.
And it's a really powerful book.
I just got through reading Wretch of the Earth, in fact. And it's very interesting. A lot of, even though it was written back, you know, 50 years ago, and it happened in North Africa, in Algeria, there's a lot of parallels. I mean, you know, they talk about in that book, about how, you know, the colonialists, you know, which we could, if we were going to make an analogy here, the United States, it'd be the corporate capitalists. You know, they try to use a class, an indigenous class, to control the population. Exactly. In other words, they'll take some of the people, you know, and make them, put them in positions that I guess it's been called, whether it's in labor or the African American community, the misleadership class, you know.
Petty bourgeoisie.
Yeah. The ones who basically are supposed to be the leaders of the people, but really are bought off, you know, and I mean, you see this stuff, it's just, so parallel. And I guess, you know, you gotta wonder, does Bernie Sanders really mean it when he says, calls for a revolution? Even if he doesn't, that's just the fact he's using the word.
Yeah.
You know?
That's important. I mean, like, seriously. And of course, I've seen a couple of stories come out recently. I think it was, I forgot what periodical said it, but they were calling him the a poor people's Vladimir Lenin and all this stuff. Like, how much longer are we going to listen to this fake Lenin and all that? Like, so they really try. So there are a few popular media outlets trying to call him out for saying revolution. But the fact that people are catching on to this and trying to really get at what a revolution means, mm-hmm. and the stages to get to that point.
Yeah.
You really see that, particularly in, like, Greece was a major example of things that we need to seriously study, because they almost broke the euro in half and tore that and basically upturned that country to the people.
Yeah.
I mean, it got almost to that point without the capitalists jumping in and doing stuff. But it's just the sense that, you know, they're at a stage now in that country where they are going through what we just talked about. Like, they're trying to do something different, but they're teetering on being reborn into being able to understand, like, that I'm ready to do this to save the people of my country.
Yeah.
So that it's a process.
Yes, indeed. And we want to emphasize again and again and again, when we talk about revolution, we're not, you know, talking about, you know, violence. We're talking about, real change. Real change. I mean, not little reforms, not little band-aids just to, you know, to patch up the existing structure. We're talking about a whole new structure in place.
Completely new one.
You know, a whole new, system, this is what cause look at our history, Gus. I mean, back in the 1930s when we were, you know, all this labor upheaval was happening, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when he instituted unemployment insurance, social security, minimum wage and all these things, it really did help people's lives, you know, in real terms. However, I mean, and put regulations on the banks, you know, the Glass-Steagall Act, and basically put controls and limitations on, you know, banks and other major corporate capitalists. But from day one, after those were put in place, because the corporations, the banks agreed to it because they were afraid of the alternative, which was, you know, people coming out with the torches and pitchforks, as they like to say.
People really don't. That's one of the things that I really dislike about how people teach the 1930s.
Yeah.
The 1930s are one of the most radical times in American history. We're talking not just strictly like education, but the unions had a very radical approach at that point that they lost.
Yeah.
After, because there was an anti-communist crackdown at the end of the 30s. And nobody talks about that period from 31 to 39.
Yeah.
When you had every real working class organization talking about serious revolution, like you just said.
Actually, up until Pearl Harbor, December of 41.
Definitely.
Really. This happened, this lasted a long time up until the 70s, you know, so you're looking at, once everything was put in place, let's say by, you know, 42, it was until like 79 when the, basically the empire struck back, if you will.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, so that was like 35 years, but still, I mean, it didn't just happen. I mean, from day one, as soon as those controls were put on, those banks and those capitalists started thinking of ways and doing things to undermine it little by little by little systematically. And so economists like Richard Wolff say, you can't just reform, because by reforming and putting regulation in place, the people you're regulating are, from day one, are going to try to undermine it, and eventually they will.
And it really
you have to change the whole power structure.
The funny thing about reform is that, you know, and Marx argues this, Marx talks about this, when you reform said system, we're actually contributing to its healing. So when you reform the capitalist system, you're actually contributing to the healing of the system, so it can take more, you know, it can continue to thrive. Mm-hmm. So that's what reform does. Reform acts against the working people. They may drop a couple of droplets of rain into your bucket, mm-hmm. but when you reform the system, you're bandaging and making the structure that is oppressing you even stronger.
Yes.
And Marx talks about that.
Yeah. And what we're talking about is basically taking control, that is the people, you know, mm-hmm. the people having, not just political democracy, but economic democracy as well. And it's gotta be, you know, at the local all the way up to the national level, you know, because now what we have is, we have a government that's supposed to regulate, businesses, you know, corporations and stuff, but that's just, that's not the case. Corporations control our government, and most actual governments of the world, with some exceptions. And, this is just horrible, because look what's happening. I mean, by them controlling our elected officials, by directly with campaign contributions to basically writing the laws, that are passed, these corporations writing the very laws that are supposed to regulate them, they've pushed the planet to a dangerous point. They've pushed people's standards of living down to a dangerous point. They've, because of their fear of losing control, they've militarized our police. And as we see what's been happening with that in the last few years, killing, you know, 10-year-old kids for playing in the park with a toy gun, you know, and other atrocities. You know, this is just, you know, it's unacceptable. And that's why we can't have them in the driving seat. We, the people, have to be in the driving seat. We're going to take a quick music break, and we're going to be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
Stick up. This is highway robbery. Corporate thugs pulled a heist on the economy. They shooting Thai criminals. For you and I, the proportions are biblical. Stole our dreams and sold us a nightmare. The gloves are off, but they don't want to fight fair. Pay your fair share. We won't budge. They occupied Boston with tents in the mud. We want jobs now, not a senator with a bobblehead like Scott Brown. And what's up with Robert Gallery? Cradles to crayons to evicting a family? There's a movement erupting, millions of people empowered to do something. This ain't about race, you must be crazy. It's black, brown, yellow, and white, 8 to 80. We the people, unified people, strength in numbers, we're gonna leave you banks frozen, 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 yeah. We the people, organized people, strength in numbers, we're gonna leave you banks frozen, frozen, a cookie, he want a glass of milk. Republicans and Democrats pass the guilt. We're indivisible as one nation. Protest vigil where you fundraise.
Okay, that was Twice Thou, Sold Out is the name of that song. Okay, quick public service announcement here. I guess that this coming Wednesday, March 2nd, Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president, will be in Champaign, and she'll be here she's here to talk about a global move of people, planet, peace over profits. She believes that this movement can never be realized within the established parties funded by Wall Street bankers, fossil fuel giants, and war profiteers. Instead, she's running with the Green Party, America's only national party that isn't poisoned by corporate money. And she's going to be this Wednesday. She's going to be at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, 501 East Daniel. It's in the corner of 5th and Daniel, and that's in room 126. And there's going to be free pizza there as well. So if you can get out 8 p.m., come out to the Graduate School Library and Information Science, corner of 5th and Daniel, 501 East Daniel, hear Jill Stein talk about you know, why she's running for president and what issues that she really wants to see happen here in this country. And this Sunday, check out Labor's Worldview TV from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6, or live at www.urbanapublictelevision.org, and see Jill Stein talk about her political platform and her presidential election campaign, rebroadcasted from C-SPAN and Larry King Live. So, okay, well, something, some really interesting stuff's been happening here locally, right, Gus? Gus made the newspaper today, front page of the local section, I guess.
Yeah.
So,
If the News Gazette was a better publication, it would be more, you know, important. And the fact is that they, what I wanted them to get, not me on it, but to actually get the people actually there, like the wide range of shots of all those groups of people out at the courthouse, because that's the powerful piece there for me.
That's like, have you seen these speeches Donald Trump does? He's always like, turn the cameras around! Turn the cameras around!
I do have people in the audience.
People, yeah. They're like all these people.
There are people here listening to me. Yeah. But anyway, I was there. I wasn't able to stay for the whole thing. So I guess maybe we should give a little background on this. Yeah. Would you like to?
Yeah, what's going on right now is that habitual abuser cop Matt Rush is continuing to collect money.
And this is the Champaign Police Department.
Mm-hmm. is continuing to collect money off of our backs, after committing horrible atrocities to multiple people. Now what's going on is that we've been asking for a prosecution of Matt Rush. The Fraternal Order of Police, which should be condemned by any real union, is actually supporting him and actually putting different quotes in newspapers how they felt like he is an upstanding police officer and that he is protecting the people by his actions. I mean, really disgusting stuff. But that's a historical trend of the Fraternal Order of Police.
Yes.
That's what they do. You know, they uphold supremacy and racial oppression by their fake union. They masquerade as a union and use labor law to do that stuff, which is a big problem. But what we were trying to do is actually get to State's Attorney Julia Reitz and get her to actually, you know, because she has the power to prosecute him and to take the dime out of his pocket, which is what he's getting right now. And so what we planned to do was to occupy her office and to give her a petition and hold a press conference there to state from different groups, different coalitions across campus and community, how the safety of the people are jeopardized with cops like Matt Rush and the cops that support and lied for him to make up those stories. And those of you that haven't read the transcripts and read the stuff he said, everything that comes out of Matt Rush's mouth is a blatant lie. And I challenge people to check out the Real Talk column that's going to come out tomorrow by my advisor and brother Sundiata Chajua, who is actually going to give very explicit details of the contradictory nature of not only Matt Rush, but also Julia Reitz.
And this Real Talk column, is this in the News Gazette?
Yes, it comes out in the News Gazette every Sunday.
Okay.
Tackling different social issues.
Okay.
And this one is going to be about Rush.
Okay. And just so people that aren't aware, this Champaign police officer, Matt Rush, I guess, the city of Champaign so far, and I emphasize so far, has paid out over $300,000 in settlements.
More than that, actually.
More than that. Yeah. To people that were brutalized, unarmed, nonviolent citizens who were beaten and brutalized by this, this cop. Now we find out just recently there's going to be a fourth lawsuit, mm-hmm. from a woman who was mentally disturbed, who was walking down the street in her nightgown. Matt Rush came up on her, threw her to the ground. She's pregnant, by the way. Came through on the ground, pushed his knee into her pregnant stomach. Mm-hmm. I mean, and jammed it into her stomach repeatedly and pepper sprayed her after he handcuffed her, put her in the back of the car. Anyway, she had a miscarriage because of this.
Yeah, she lost the
baby. Know? Yeah. And, you know, this is just, I mean, so, and Julia Reitz's, her solution to the problem is that she suggests that the city of Champaign, pay Matt Rush $300,000, pay him $300,000 so he can, retire, early from the, I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah.
And, this is the thing is the, current chief of police of Champaign, Anthony Cobb,
wow,
wanted to fire him, but was prevented from doing that because of the Fraternal Order of Police's use of a labor arbitration.
Yeah, that's because all those contributions, you know, they send this mail and stuff to your house, and would you like to donate to the Fraternal Order of Police?
The policeman's ball, or whatever.
Well, then they give it to the politicians. I don't know. But no, wait a minute, Dave. Look at the precedent this sets. It's like, okay, go out and really abuse four people, and we'll give you pay you off with $300,000.
Yeah,
I mean, we're talking.
Yeah,
if you talk about court costs, you talk about lawyer fees and the payouts. The city has given over $800,000 in this stuff to Matt Rush, and with this new case, that's going to probably go up to $250,000, $300,000. It's going to go. We're going to hit $1 million.
Yeah, $1 million.
Oh my God,
$1 million, Matt.
I was. I was way off of my figure. Holy.
No, because Julia Reitz met with community leaders, particularly pastors and other community people, and those were the numbers were very high, given out like, yeah, this is, we're reaching to $1 million here once this new case is settled. So we're talking about $1 million that has been put into the community to build up the infrastructure and actually create jobs, because the unemployment rate here is considering that it's supposed to be a recovery, is really bad. There are a lot of struggling, poor, and working people here.
And this is supposed to be the most prosperous community in downstate Illinois.
Well, actually not, Dave.
Supposedly.
Well.
You know, because of the university, you know.
Well, no, it used to be. I don't know. It's really, probably has really changed. But I remember in the 80s, I was doing a lot of research on things. Actually, it was a class project on buying or starting a radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And, what I found out was actually Peoria and Decatur had higher per capita incomes.
Interesting.
But that, at that time, that was still when they had the strong unions though.
And the
but,
industry,
and
yeah.
Champaign was known as a reputation as a low income town because of the university.
Yeah. Well, but the image is that it's a prosperous community. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
image.
But they aren't seeing all the business building service workers and everybody else who are still, you know, fairly low income, even though they are represented by a union.
Yeah.
Compared
so,
to
anyway, go on, Gus. So, I guess this, there was a press conference, a meeting with the African American community ministers, and
yeah,
Carol Ammons was
the state representative
there.
Julia Reitz is extremely contradictory in the things that she is saying and doing. You know, she's saying that it's the Champaign Police Department's job to deal with Rush.
they tried.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, but the state's attorney is either too cowardly or what we heard from her, because we actually confronted her in the courthouse yesterday during the press conference, and she said that she believed from actually watching the evidence that she believed that he did not do anything wrong. That she actually said that, because we were like,
so why did the city pay this money out to those people?
Exactly. So like I said, this is the kind of person that is supposedly a representative of the people. Julia Reitz has to go.
Yeah.
And that was our big thing, is like, she has to go. And unfortunately, We need somebody to step up to run against her and get her out of office, because from what I've heard of the history here is that she's done things like this in the past that have seriously jeopardized the people's lives in this city, and she continues to hold that office.
Maybe Matt knows more. He has a little dirt on some of them.
Well,
I think it's her disposition, actually, her attitude.
Well, Dave,
I think it's her belief system.
Yeah. Or Gus, you weren't here at the time, but she started out like this with the that videotaping incident.
Yes, with Patrick Thompson and Martell Miller.
And
yes,
she was on completely on the wrong side of that. They tried to set one of those guys up with
a woman who's in trouble with the law.
Right, an informer, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard about that.
So anyway, there was this rally at the courthouse yesterday, and I know Carol Ammons, State Representative Carol Ammons, has come out and basically said that something's got to be done. He has to go. Matt Rush has to go from the Champaign Police Department. So anyway, this rally happened yesterday, and you want to kind of go from there, because there's a lot of interesting things that happened there.
Yeah. What happened was that we had the rally, and the issue really came when we tried to enter the building and the police started putting hands on people, you know, pushing them out of the building, you know, and that, and you know, so it got very tense there. And the main reason why it is so tense, because not only does Julia Reitz feel the heat, but this city is really boiling now about this arrest situation, particularly from that fourth incident that's come out. This is something that is not going to go away anytime soon, particularly after this past Friday. And like you say, State Representative Carol Ammons came out on Thursday during her press conference and condemned Julia Reitz and the actions, you know, going forward, because Julia Reitz has the power to remove Matt Rush and by filing criminal charges. And at least an investigation. She said that based on what she saw in the video footage, and if anybody that's listening hasn't seen the video footage, please, where is it? Where is it at online? It's somewhere. I can't remember where it's at. But if you get a chance to find it and look at it, you need to see it, because the footage of the four of the police brutality cases, like the video footage of Matt Rush beating these people.
All of these things happening. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the footage is available online. I don't remember what website it's on, but if you get a chance to see it,
yeah,
it shows that number one, that Rush was easily the aggressor in every case, and it would warrant at least an investigation. She said that she didn't even feel like it deserved an investigation based on what she saw.
In about 4 weeks here, we're going to be having an acquaintance and friend of mine on the show who actually took video footage of Matt Rush in one of these beating cases that he took footage of a huge settlement. And you know, that still, like, again, begs the question. Obviously, the attorneys for these people that were brutalized must have had a pretty good case with that film footage, or the city wouldn't have paid them. I mean, my gosh, I mean, that's just common sense, you know? I mean, do you think they're going to pay out money to anybody that just comes with a frivolous claim? So, but anyway, I guess after people were admitted to the courthouse, I guess on the way up to Julia Reitz's office, I guess I heard that a local African-American activist, Martell Miller, whose son was beaten up by this Matt Rush several years ago, law officer or deputy or somebody there was trying to actually provoke a confrontation with him, right?
Yeah, somebody that we've never even seen before, but it's apparently an investigator for Reitz's office.
Okay.
But, you know, nobody knew. And, you know, what he did was, and we saw this because this is what the police do, is he tried to get in Martell. Martell at that point was already very heavily agitated. He tried to get in his face, and we actually had to create a wall to keep him because he was trying to provoke an assault charge.
Okay. Well, let's see. I guess I'll take this call. What the heck? Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, I just wanted to give the information about where that video can be seen.
Yes, the video footage.
Also, where you can sign a petition.
Okay, and where is that?
On the Facebook page for Champaign-Urbana, Citizens for Peace and Justice.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Facebook page of CU Citizens for Peace and Justice, okay.
Yep, CUCPJ. You can see the video, warning to the audience. It's very, very disturbing. Very disturbing to see, but I think everybody should see it. Precious Jackson went through that, and we should have the stomach to witness and speak out about it.
Okay, and that's CUCPJ?
Yes, their Facebook page.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling in with that information.
All right, keep up the good work. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
So that means
we got another call. Just a second. I'll let you talk to Angela. Hold on just a second. Hello, WFT. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it's possible for Assemblywoman Ammons to get the feds involved in here to look into Matt Rush and the Champaign City Police Department.
Well, that's a very good question about involving the federal government in this somehow, the Department of Justice. That's been tried in the past, I know, with not any success. But, you know, this case might be different. That's a very good idea.
Well, Rush needs to go. There's no doubt about that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling. Okay, Angela.
Yeah, I was going to say it sounds like publicity to me. But how can you actually see this and nothing is being done? So that goes to show you how our system here works, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's like what Dave said, you know, it's clearly at this point that Julia Reitz has an ideology that aligns her against African Americans at this point.
Thought process.
I mean, we're like, I mean, this is what we saw the same thing with Eric Garner. The footage clearly showed that he was taken down by a police officer and killed in the chokehold. That was a clear video footage. And the same thing with the disgusting videos that Matt Rush doing these things to these people. I mean, really heinous acts. Like the caller said, very disturbing if you see the footage. I mean, this is Julie Reese basically affirming not only that she doesn't care about the safety and lives of the people in this area, but she is willing to continue to degenerate the economic conditions by paying this money out to these different groups and to possibly give it to Matt Rush.
Yeah. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Jim Iman checking in.
Hi, Jim.
I want to go back to Gus's remarks on reform. The last person to save capitalism in this country was FDR.
Uh-huh.
And his mother's family, the Delanos, made billions and billions of dollars on the opium trade in China.
No kidding.
Absolutely.
Well, there's an old saying that behind every fortune there's a history of massive crime somewhere.
Behind every great fortune is a great crime.
Thank you, Bill.
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right about that. Just thought I'd check in with this. It's a good show. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so anyway, Julia Reitz, when all these people came and she was given her usual, I guess, song and dance and everything, basically there was people that basically were setting the record straight.
And Sundi Adichajua clearly told her, like, first off, you know, Julia Reitz said that the witness corroborated, you know, Rush's statement, when in fact that's not true. The witness only corroborated the statement before before she got in the car. You know, the witness drove off. So there's so much other stuff. So Reese basically lied to us in our face because the witness did not see everything that happened during the entire incident. Yet she's claiming that it corroborates Matt Rush's story. So it's just a bunch of garbage, really. Mm-hmm. So now, like I said, there needs to be a serious, coordinated, discipline understanding of how to protest not only Rush getting sent to prison, but also getting rid of Julia Reitz. We cannot exist in this space with her as state's attorney anymore.
You're right, Gus. And you know what? Before any solution or any of that, the hearts and the minds of these people need to be worked. You know, there needs to be some work on how their thinking process.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing with that is that I'm one of the ones that argues that Reitz, she's gonna be who she's gonna be. You know, there's really no changing her thought process.
Well, she needs to, I mean, she has to go. So does Matt.
Yeah, she has to go. That's the point. She is clearly not a representative of Champaign County.
She's a representative of any place.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, she does not have the right to hold her position based on what happened. So, like I said, the press conference on Thursday, then the press conference and rally on Friday, you know, these are the first two events, but we cannot let this thing go down until another incident happens or somebody else comes forward. We got to consistently put pressure on Reitz and use organized tactics from the community, actually go in the community and use organized tactics to put pressure on her to either resign or find somebody that can run against her and get her out of office. Right. So, you know, cause like I said, this thing with Rush, it's really, I've never seen, and I've only been here 3 years, and this is one of the things that I've seen the community really, really unify on, because we're talking about all classes are saying that Matt Rush has, I mean, because he's bad business for the capitalists. They are really upset. They're as upset as we are.
I'm sure.
So like I said, he's bad business for everybody. So you have a unified class front to get Matt Rush out of here. But it depends on the working people, and particularly African Americans want him to go to jail for assaulting
to jail.
Exactly.
I mean, he committed several crimes.
Assault and battery. Yeah.
And he shouldn't even, I mean, it shouldn't even went this far for him to constantly keep doing this stuff. I mean, Who was his supervisor?
Well, Anthony Cobb, the chief of police, wanted to fire him.
Yeah,
you know?
He tried to fire. He actually did fire him, but the fraternal order used labor law and arbitration to get him back.
How much? I mean, okay. So they but what would happen if the city just said we're not going to abide by the arbitrator's decision? I mean,
it happens all the time, actually. Because you know what?
Is that a contract thing?
No, you know what happens, because that's what's going on right now at the University of Illinois, because we won our arbitration against them for tuition waivers, and we've been told that they are not going to follow the arbitration rule.
Okay.
So you can do that. You got to go to the National Labor Relations Board.
And even if Matt Rush would sue him and win, I'll bet you the amount of payout would be a lot less than
be a lot less.
Yeah.
So again, like I said.
And it'd get rid of a bad apple.
So that's why I think you're right, Dave. I think it's about ideology, because they could stand up and say, we're not going to follow this, because the university has done it to the GEO constantly, has not followed labor law. We won an arbitration. So they could have easily said, we're not going to follow this. This guy is a despicable officer who is hurting civilian life. We can't have him on the street, and we can't have him collecting money. They could do that if they wanted to, but that's why we're going to get into the ideology. Ideology matters.
Sure. And I mean, unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there that feel like the police should be able to do whatever they want. You know, and I mean, that's what's really disturbing. You
know? Luckily, that's changing.
Yeah.
Because I believe that, like I said, there has been a consciousness awakening ever since and again, people really take down Rodney King and stuff, but ever since the Los Angeles Rebellion of the early 1990s, it's been slowly brewing. Even in the late 90s, you heard some stuff about it, but not as much because of the, you know, 9/11 came along, et cetera. But there's been something there.
Hey, man, that's a $300 microphone, Gus.
Oh, sorry.
Gus got excited there.
Yeah, well, I remember in the 1990s, there would be, the people, there was a trend at one point, a little fadlet of, t-shirts that said, it's a black thing you wouldn't understand. And a lot of people were like, what are these people talking, you know? But that was that kind of a consciousness, I think, was sort of about the same time you were talking about, a few years after that. And I was really fascinated on the way to the station listening to you guys today talk about, you know, how you're seeing these cultural, what I will call cultural trends develop, you know, and being over the long run. And maybe this, I don't know, Trump-Sanders
the billion
contest could be really interesting.
Yeah, indeed.
I don't see, you know, Super Tuesday. Hillary's going to get Super Tuesday, unfortunately. But, you know, that's...
Well, maybe Trump-Sanders ticket.
Yeah. I doubt that. But I don't know. This is going to be interesting. However it turns out, it's going to be interesting. I mean, this is pretty unprecedented. I mean, I haven't seen anything this interesting since the 1960s, to be honest with you. You know, because... Even, you know, let's put it this way. If Sanders loses, I mean, there's going to be a lot of angry people, a lot of angry Sanders supporters, and then rightly so, because that's probably how Hillary's going to win it, is through the whole superdelegate thing. And then people are going to see for themselves how rigged the system is.
And you know who the majority of his supporters are the young people. And, you know, they're at that age now. Remember, during the 60s and 70s, you know, the organizing capacity of groups came from those teenagers and early 20 people, the ones who support Sanders. So again, like I said, this is like what Fanon's talking about. It's a stage that has to happen where you develop that national consciousness. You realize that there's another stage, that this isn't what's going to work. And once they see that the system is going to fail them and Bernie Sanders isn't going to win this, and other things are going to happen because a recession is coming at the end of this year, all these different factors.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
It's the eighth year since the last one.
Yeah.
So the economic indicators are already forecasting it now. I mean, that's why you have so many layoffs that we've been doing on this show, every news story. Yeah, they're forecasting it right now, and the Wall Street Journal is as well. But like I said, all these different economic factors are in place to where there's going to be a consciousness raising from particularly young working class people as they continue to lose material conditions. And you know, that's what the heart of struggle is about, is as bad as repression gets, I mean, you know, oppression, the dialectical relationship to resistance develops. And that's something we always got to remember. Yes, it's terrible, but that terribleness is leading to something phenomenal that's coming.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's long overdue in my opinion. I mean, it's just, you know, it seems like it's been like kind of a slow strangulation, you know.
It is.
It seems like to me that it's been, I mean, my lifetime, I'm 58 years old. I mean, I graduated high school in 1975.
Kid.
And, by 1 year, right. But you know, it was like, you know, when we graduated high school, Bill, in 74, 75, kind of that mid-70s period, I mean, it was a very hopeful time. I mean, the Vietnam War was ended because of people mobilizing the streets. We got rid of a crooked president, you know, through Watergate investigations. They had the church committee hearings on abuse by the CIA and other investigations of assassinations committee, which reopened the case of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Dr. Martin Luther King. And it was really looked like things were going to be happening. I mean, finally, things were turned around, and a lot of things changed. Not to mention what you know, the civil rights is, you know, that happened a few, you know, all the changes, you know, ending the segregation laws and all that. And then, you know, by the late 70s, it seems like the empire started striking back slowly and systematically. And by 1980, and it seems like it's been downhill ever since the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980.
Dave,
whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House.
Yeah, well, I think the 1960s ended around 1972, possibly 1974. And those good things are happening, but the roots of a lot of problems were coming out because yep. how Nixon got elected president,
mm-hmm.
for example, the beginnings of all of that, the South going Republican and Republican Party becoming racist.
And George Meany, the head of the AFL, National AFL-CIO, made no endorsement in the national,
right.
in the national okay. election between, Richard Nixon and George McGovern.
Yeah. And one of the things that you didn't touch on there that Jeremy Brecker points out in the book Strike,
yeah.
a classic book, it was that the early 1970s, was a really big time of labor ferment in the United
Strikes
States.
And walk-ons.
Right, the, Wildcat post office strike, for one thing, mm-hmm. and, the somewhat, informal organization of millions of housewives boycotting beef when it went up real high at one point.
Yep. Oh, yes.
And mm-hmm. another one too, 1973, now this is where the things are starting to go bad. We had the oil embargo.
Yep.
The gas prices went up. Oh man! Ever since then, Americans have just hated Arabs. You know, and it's grown and it's gotten into different things. Now it's more Muslims, which yeah. includes Indonesians. You know, and
yeah, but you know, there's a lot behind that 73 oil embargo.
But see, that's
yeah.
what was starting.
But that's
you know
what's
the
perception.
economic conditions. Well, for example, in real terms. We haven't had a raise really in wages or our social wages or any benefits we would get from the government since about 1968.
Yeah.
So you might see
in real terms. Yeah.
Right. That's sort of a decline right there.
Yeah. You look at all the economic data too, as far as, like starting in about the 1940s, you know, World War II, you see graphs of the economic data. Of
right.
Wages mm-hmm. and corporate profits, and the wealth, income that basically they're all completely parallel, and then starting about
folks, Dave has his hands
yeah,
parallel together.
Yeah, 1980, all of a sudden, profits and wealth, I mean, just skyrocketing.
Now with his left hand
yeah.
is skyrocketing.
Where wages actually continued, they were flattened, have actually gone down a little bit in real terms.
Well, I got a better
in
word
real
for
terms.
You.
Yeah.
I've seen this graph several times, and it starts at the beginning of the 20th century. And it goes out, but I'd need three hands to do
yeah,
this.
Yeah, okay.
And what happens is productivity, profits, and wages,
mm-hmm,
okay?
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the 20th century, pretty much those things all went up together,
mm-hmm.
all right? Maybe after, World War II and stuff, I think maybe, wages might have been, were,
getting
they
closer
were,
to profits.
Yeah, they were catching up,
mm-hmm.
all right? But then it hits around 1970. And all of a sudden, the profits and productivity, they skyrocket. I mean, they start, and they're not going at the 45 degree anymore around 1970 with a lot of the automation and stuff.
Yeah.
Productivity just shot straight up. Corporate profits went right with it. Wages flat.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so we've been robbed of our labor
yes.
all these years of our productivity.
Yes.
That's for example, there's a guy I know, he's retired from Caterpillar. In the early 1970s, he did something there. He was like a machinist, but
yeah.
he had to do some record keeping.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, he was doing it on paper and he could only do so much a day. And then they came in with some real primitive, you know, computer-based thing. And it was like he could do hundreds times more. Mm-hmm. It was just that one innovation. But did he get a big raise? No.
He probably got fired.
Well, no, he didn't get fired, but he didn't get, at one point he would have been laid off, and at other points he would have been on strike trying to get what he deserved.
Yeah. And, you know, those are some real good points. And on top of all that, the wealthiest people in this society pay less taxes than the average working person. They pay half as much in their real tax rates than we do. I mean, that's the abominable thing.
Which is really one of the most illogical aspects of our economic system, really.
Yes.
So you would call that confiscating.
Confiscating? Yeah, in a way.
Redistribution of wealth.
Yeah. Indeed. I mean, that's what's obscene is the fact that these people, I mean, that are the disparities in wealth between the wealthiest. I mean, we're talking about the top, the top 5%, if not the 1% or the 0.1%. I mean, they have been just, you know, their incomes have gone up in real terms, you know, just exponentially hand over fist, and where the average working person, they're actually have been losing ground in real terms. And yet they pay half the taxes we do. Now, of course, if you listen to the corporate media, you know, they're talking about those are the job creators. Yeah. When actually they're the job destroyers, you know.
Bill, you know, that's sort of a godlike term.
Yes.
You know,
indeed.
Because
hold
that's
on.
What we refer to as God.
Hello, WFT, you're on the air. Hello, WFT, you're on the air. Oh, I'm sorry. Somebody's talking, but I can't hear you. I'm sorry. There's no volume. Try calling back. Thank you. Okay, but anyway, you know, we're about out of time here, and so is there any last words from everybody today?
I think, my last words are that we have to look at the foundation. See, it starts with the foundation. Mm-hmm. If the foundation isn't built correctly and put in the proper, you know, agenda or whatever, then, you know, it's not going to work. But I feel like we need to vote out and, like you said, Gus, keep continuing to go at these people and just do what we have to do, because if not, this is going to continue.
And get worse, probably.
And get worse. Yeah. It's going to get worse. It's already getting worse. And it's so bad that we don't even have a clue how bad it is.
Yeah. And Bill and I, being building trades people, we know that getting the foundation right is a very important part of building the new structure. Yeah. You know, Gus?
Correct. You know, Bill makes the best point, really, in that we're talking wage theft. Wage theft is something that, you know, reparations talks have always been about, in the sense that people think that it's about, you know, like, you know, we want an apology or something like that. No, when we look at the working people in this country, and Bill said it best, when wages stagnated and regressed, you had a theft of labor. You had a theft of wages that have to be redistributed from the wealth that this country has made. And that's the major central argument of any struggle in this country, and any struggle anywhere, because of global capitalism, is the idea of redistributing the wealth that has been stolen from the working people.
And you know what? It's bad. You shouldn't have if people get too wealthy, if there's a small group of people that get extremely, obscenely wealthy, it's bad for democracy because they can buy off our elected officials, and it's bad for the economy because they get to a point to where they don't know what to do with their money. There's not enough investment opportunities, so they start investing in these, it's almost like gambling. I mean, these derivatives and stuff, and that's part of the reason what caused the financial meltdown in 2008.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, and it's... Besides that, it's like, what's the whole point of our civilization, our society? And, is it to enrich these few people? I've heard all my life about all of these machines and everything starting out when I was a little kid. They're labor-saving devices.
Yeah.
You know, but, apparently they're income-reducing devices too.
Yeah.
Because but the whole thing is, just think of all the tens of millions, hundreds of millions of lives just in this country over the last 40 years that are so much, have been so much more diminished. People could have been much more people. They were forced to be poor and not live up to their, to
full
their potential.
Potential. Sure.
You
and,
know,
and technology, it can be used in a good sense in the, as far as like, you know, it could be directed.
We can have the 4 hour day.
Yeah, we can have
you
the
know,
4 hour day.
That's it. And we could spend 4 hours doing something
else
that's really good for other people. You know, like donating money to WEFT.
Okay.
It builds up our life and builds up our community because.
Right. It makes people feel better.
Because the biggest thing, like we really, there hasn't been a really good significant theoretical study since Marx about the what labor does to the body and the mind.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, I mean, like, could you imagine the type of life expectancy and the health of people with the 4 hour day
yeah.
and the money that, I mean, the community money. Like I said, this is a very critical conversation.
The 4 hour, you can find old wobbly posters 100 years old that call for the 4 hour day.
Okay, caller, I'm afraid
they had a bad depression.
I'm gonna try taking this one more call here. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
It's Jim Iman again.
Yes, Jim.
Bernie Sanders has yet to come out. In fact, he's opposed to reparations for slavery. He's got to be pushed on this question. That money could go to improvements in the black communities. It's really crux for his chances, but I just thought I'd mention that.
Okay. You know, thank you, Jim, for calling him. Yeah, we gotta have I think we need to have a whole program on that sometime, Gus, is maybe the whole issue of reparations and stuff. Cause I think it's a really interesting issue that I think has a lot of different facets to it and need to be discussed. Okay, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour and let's support a community radio station, WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned for the Union Edge and until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.